Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about the Spring for Shell vulnerability, which for a short period of time last week had people running around with their hair on fire. And we'll also be discussing two new pieces of research from us at Semantic, one about the latest campaign by the SICATA APT group, also known as APT10, and another intriguing bit of research about quite an advanced piece of malware that was being used for some pretty low-level cybercrime.
Yeah, but before we move on to that, Dick, maybe let's turn our attention to the ongoing Ukraine invasion. So the invasion is obviously continuing, as we know, but there have been a few interesting developments on the cyber front as well.
Yes, there has. There's been a few things worth discussing, all right. And probably the most noticeable thing, or notable thing, I should say, is some news that came out earlier this week, which threw some light on an incident that occurred at the very start of the invasion. And that was the mysterious outage of Viasat satellites, KASAT network. I think that's how you pronounce it. But that outage coincided with the Russian invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. So this incident crippled tens of thousands of satellite modems across Europe. And while the outage seemed to be quite concentrated on the Ukraine, it did have an impact much further afield. So, for example, it affected some 5,800 Enercon wind turbines in Germany, leaving them unable to communicate for remote monitoring purposes or remote control purposes. So I call this incident mysterious because for a long time afterwards, nobody really seemed to know just what had happened. So the timing suggested that this was part of the pre-invasion wave of cyber attacks running alongside the disk wiping attacks that we've already discussed on this podcast. And certainly something like this would play a part in disrupting communications at a time when you wanted to sow confusion and achieve a degree of surprise. Yet nobody really seemed to be able to verify just what had happened. And it did prompt a lot of people to wonder if it was just a coincidence, maybe. But only now, thanks to some very good research from our peers at Sentinel-1, do we finally have a complete picture of what happened. And it turns out that a wiper was also involved in this attack. In this case, one that was designed specifically to wreck devices like this. So the wiper has been given quite an appropriate name of Acid Rain. It's a MIPS ELF executable, and it's a pretty straightforward wiper. It just overwrites the entire file system and various known storage device files. So Sentinel-1 kind of, you know, they described it as a fairly crude piece of malware. They described it as brute force. And they said that suggested that the attackers were either unfamiliar with the targeted firmware or they wanted to create a tool that could potentially be reused again against other devices.
Okay, that's quite interesting. But have Viasat confirmed these findings?
Yes, they have. So prior to the Sentinel-1 blog going out, they had their own report, which was a little bit confusing because it was kind of unclear as to how the wiping was actually done. And you could be forgiven for thinking that the attackers were just issuing commands to these modems. However, Viasat subsequently came out after the Sentinel-1 blog was published, and they confirmed the use of the wiper malware against modems on their network. They indicated that the attackers exploited a misconfigured VPN appliance and that gave them management to the gave them access to the trust management segment of the KASAT network. That allowed them to move laterally across the network, and then they were able to use the privileges they'd acquired to execute legitimate targeted management commands on a large number of residential modems simultaneously. And it was these commands then that appear to be used to deliver the malware to the targeted devices.
Okay, and I mean, do we know who was behind this attack? Do we have any evidence about that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's the widespread suspicion that this was Russian-sponsored. But beyond that, there's nothing terribly concrete. There is one bit of inconclusive evidence, and that's Sentinel-1 found some code overlap between Acid Rain and VPN Filter. So VPN Filter, as many of you may recall, was a fairly wide-ranging campaign that was uncovered in 2018. And it involved infecting as many as 500,000 routers from various different manufacturers with malware. And it could do a range of different things, but snooping around seemed to be its main purpose. So that link between the two pieces of malware is interesting for two reasons. First, while VPN Filter had a worldwide impact, it was reportedly very heavy focused on Ukraine. And secondly, the US and British governments have subsequently attributed VPN Filter to Sandworm, which is a Russian APT actor that is believed to be linked to GRU, which is Russian military intelligence. Sandworm is quite an interesting ATP-type group. APT-type group. They seem to specialize in sort of more niche types of attacks. So, you know, attacks against routers, they're linked to the NotPetya ransomware stroke wiper attack against Ukraine, and they were also linked to the attacks against the Ukrainian power grid in December 2015. So, you know, given the background in attacks on routers and devices like that, you know, yeah, maybe there is a link there, but this is sort of a low confidence thing. And I think you probably need some more conclusive evidence to make a firm attribution to Sandworm.
Mm-hmm. And then is there anything else of interest going on then?
Yeah, there's lots of bits and pieces coming out. And indeed, the Ukraine government themselves are really good at sharing information. There's been a steady stream of updates coming out of CERT UA, providing details on new campaigns. And perhaps the most interesting thing to emerge this week was an advisory they issued about what looks like a new Shockworm campaign. This group is also known as Gamereddon or Armageddon, and it's a Russian-sponsored group that exclusively targets Ukraine. Well, used to. I'll get to that in a minute. So anyway, this latest campaign involves a number of RAR archives named either assistance.RAR or necessary_military_assistance.RAR. And each of these archives, they contained malicious shortcode files entitled List of Necessary Things for the Provision of Military Humanitarian Assistance to Ukraine, or Providing Military Humanitarian Assistance to Ukraine. So these were being emailed around. But what is notable, you know, this is very much in line with the TTPs used by Shockworm, but what's notable is the use of English in the names of the files and in the text of the emails, and the fact that at least some of these emails were being sent to targets in the Latvian government. And that's kind of interesting because today Shockworm has usually just focused on Ukraine, and they seem to be, in this campaign at least, kind of broadening their reach into neighbouring countries in the European Union.
Yeah, that's an interesting development, all right.
So let's turn to you, Richard, because you've got lots to talk about this week. You've been involved in lots of bits of research that we've put out. I don't know where you want to start. I think maybe we'll take a look at the Cicada research we did.
Yeah, you're right. We pushed out a few blogs, all right, over the last week. So yeah, I might discuss our Cicada research first. And maybe before I get into, I suppose, our specific blog, I might just kind of tell the listeners, I guess, about who Cicada is, you know, in case anyone isn't familiar with them. So Cicada is like an advanced persistent threat group, an APT group. They've been active for a long time. They've been around since at least 2009, possibly even earlier. And they have been linked officially by US government officials to the Chinese government. That link was made when two of the group's members were arrested back, or indicted, I should say, back in 2018. So it is a typical kind of state-sponsored APT group, originating out of China. And it used to be known for primarily targeting Japanese or Japanese kind of linked companies. But then it did seem to widen its focus and it started targeting managed service providers and MSPs that had a more global footprint. But this new research from us, this latest campaign with details, it seems to point to a further widening of the group's activity.
Okay, so what's been involved in, in this latest round of activity?
Yeah, so this current campaign, it's pretty widespread in terms of both the sectors and the kind of geographies targeted. There's a strong focus on victims in the government and the NGO sectors. Some of those organisations are also working in the areas of religion and education. And then there are also some victims in the telecoms, legal and pharmaceutical sectors. But certainly government and non-profit organisations do seem to be the main focus of this campaign. And location-wise, we saw victims in a large number of countries and regions. And we saw victims in the US, Canada, Hong Kong, Turkey, Israel, India, Montenegro and Italy as well. And there was also one victim in Japan, which is notable due to Cicada's, you know, previous strong focus in past campaigns on companies in Japan and companies linked to Japan. But this campaign, it does appear to indicate, you know, a further widening of Cicada's targeting, particularly when it comes to the sectors targeted. So I think it was clear they were going for a bit more of a global focus targeting the MSPs. But this campaign is definitely interesting due to the kind of strong focus we're seeing on government orgs and nonprofits, especially. And this campaign as well, it was also pretty long running. It started in around mid-2021, from what we could see. And it's continued until at least February this year, you know, meaning that there's a possibility that this activity could yet be ongoing. And the attackers were able to target a large number of victims at the same time. They were able to spend a long time on the networks of some victims. And in some cases, you know, we saw them maintaining a presence on victim networks for, you know, as long as 9 months, which is a significant period of time.
All right. So given the previous very narrow focus on Japan and all that, the targeting here is very unusual for this group. How did we link it to Cicada?
Yeah, it's definitely a bit unusual, but the attribution of this activity basically is based on the presence on victim networks of both a custom loader and custom malware that are believed to be exclusively used by Cicada. So the malware in question is SodaMaster, which is a fileless malware and a pretty powerful backdoor. And that's believed to have been exclusively used by Cicada since around 2020. And the custom loader in question was also seen used in previous publicly reported Cicada attacks as well. So it's pretty strong link to the group. And then some of the other TTPs deployed in this campaign, you know, we see DLL side loading being used. We see the use of certain tools like a RAR archiving tool. We see WIM exec being used as well. And these tools, they've been seen being used in past Cicada campaigns as well. As well as this, you know, the targeting of multiple large organizations and multiple countries all at the same time, that would need a lot of resources and skills that we generally do only see in nation state backed groups like Cicada. And I suppose it also shows us that this group still has a lot of kind of firepower behind it when it comes to its cyber activities.
Okay. And, you know, the change in targeting is interesting, but what do we think was the motivation in this campaign?
Yeah, well, the sorts of organisations that we see targeted, you know, the non-profits and government orgs, they're most likely to be of interest to this group for espionage purposes, which is typically the kind of campaigns Cicada has carried out. You know, this is the sort of activity we've seen them carrying out in the past, and as well as that, the kind of activity we see on victim machines. You know, we see, you know, data being kind of put into zip files and things like that, you know, so very much seems that the motivation behind this campaign at all points to being espionage, really.
Okay, let's move on because we had another bit of research you were involved with that we put out last week. And this one's kind of fascinating. It's a bit different from the usual blogs we publish. It's all about some new malware that we found that we've called VerbalCon.
Yeah, so like you say, Dick, you know, typically our blogs do cover the activities of, you know, APT groups like Cicada or maybe sophisticated cybercrime actors like those involved in ransomware, that kind of thing. But this kind of piece of research, it was a bit different, as we believe this activity was being carried out by an unknown, you know, likely quite unsophisticated, probable kind of lone actor. But what makes the activity interesting is that the way the malware is deployed and the campaign is kind of carried out is quite sophisticated. And I guess it's more kind of reminiscent of activity we would normally see, you know, carried out by more sort of sophisticated, like professional kind of cyber actors.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit more about how the malware works and the campaign it was being used in?
Yeah, so Vermicon is basically, it's loaded as a server-side polymorphic jar file. And that means basically that the file is, the fact it's polymorphic means that due to encryption and obfuscation, the code in the malware payload basically looks different each time it is downloaded. So attackers generally do this, they pack malware like this in an effort to evade detection by security software. And the malware samples that were analyzed by Symantec, they were fully obfuscated in the code flow and the strings and the symbols. And while the samples themselves, they may have been based on publicly available code, it's kind of the way they're packed and the efforts taken by the attacker sort of hide the true nature of the malware that really make this campaign notable. So the attacker takes multiple steps to check if the malware is being run in a virtual machine environment, you know, which obviously might indicate it was being opened on a security researcher's machine or something like that. If they're satisfied with those checks, then the malware basically starts to send information about the infected machine back to its CNC server and then takes various other steps before downloading the payload, which is also obfuscated in a similar manner and also contains similar techniques to detect the virtualization environment as well as some other functionality. And it's also a jar file as well. And then when this is eventually decrypted, it points to a URL that contains a configuration file for a cryptocurrency miner. So this indicates that the goal of this attacker was to install cryptocurrency mining software on victim machines. And I mean, this is pretty interesting as it, you know, would appear to be a relatively low reward goal for the attacker, given the level of effort that would have been required to kind of develop this sort of sophisticated malware to carry out this kind of campaign. And as well as that, there are indications that the attacker may be stealing Discord tokens and using these then as well to advertise Trojanized video game applications, likely as another redistribution channel for Vermicon.
Yeah, I remember hearing about this first and being my ears pricked up a bit, and I asked, well, what do you think they're doing? And the reply was stealing Discord tokens. And I was completely stumped. So, we found it being used for cryptocurrency mining, but could it be used for other purposes such as delivering ransomware, for example?
So most of the infections we saw where this malware was used were on non-enterprise machines, which obviously would rarely see ransomware deployed on non-enterprise machines these days. There were previous reports that have connected related domains to a single occurrence of ransomware, but the infrastructure may be shared with an unrelated actor. So we don't have any evidence to indicate that Vermicon has been used in any more serious attacks. However, you know, while the activity we've seen being carried out using this loader, it indicates that it may be being used by an individual who might not kind of realize the capabilities of the malware that they are using. But if it did fall into the hands of a more sophisticated actor, you know, the potential may be there for this loader to be used for more serious attacks, and that could potentially include ransomware and espionage campaigns. But really, the person who's using it at the moment does not seem to be interested in carrying out that kind of activity.
Well, let's hope their disinterest in that continues.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And one more thing to discuss this week, that's the Spring for Shell vulnerability. It caused a lot of headlines towards the end of last week, but would you be able to tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, so I think news started breaking about this vulnerability on Wednesday and Thursday last week. I think it was when we logged on an hour Thursday morning. It was all kind of after kicking off. But Spring for Shell basically is a vulnerability in the very widely used Spring Core Java framework that could allow for unauthenticated remote code execution on vulnerable applications. And when news about it initially broke, it was a zero-day vulnerability. Basically, a patch hadn't been issued for it yet. And proof of exploit concept code to exploit the vulnerability had been quickly leaked online. And so it was quickly reported that the bug was then being actively exploited in attacks. So I think that's kind of what led to the sort of panic initially.
Yeah, it definitely would. The name of the bug is clearly inspired by Log4Shell, which was discovered last year. But is it as serious as that?
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly, you know, the naming of it was clearly, I think, inspired to tie it to that. But I think the answer is probably no, it's not as serious. There was definitely initial confusion about the potential severity of this bug, of spring core shell. So while it was initially reported that all versions of spring core with the JDK version greater than or equal to 9.0 were vulnerable to it, researchers, in fairness, quite quickly determined that spring core must be configured in a certain way to be vulnerable. And then when Spring released its vulnerability report, it itself stated that for the specific exploit to work, an application must meet a series of prerequisites, including being JDK 9 or higher, Apache Tomcat being used as a server container, be packaged as WAR, and then have a Spring Web MVC or Spring Webflux dependency. So it had to meet a number of prerequisites. And applications that were deployed in default mode weren't vulnerable to the exploit, although Spring itself did say that there may have been more ways to exploit the vulnerability than those that had been outlined. But given the prerequisites, it wasn't clear then how many instances of the Spring Core Java framework may have been vulnerable to the bug. And to be fair, a patch was also very quickly issued by Spring, which said that the bug had been reported to its researcher, or bug had been reported to it by researchers from Ant Group FG on Tuesday night last, with the team having intended to release emergency patches for the bug on Thursday, but then details of the bug basically were leaked online ahead of that on Wednesday. However, on Thursday, Spring did then release updates to the framework that did patch the bug apparently.
Okay. And let's take a look at impact. Have we seen many successful exploits of the bug since last week?
I mean, I don't think there has been anything notable reported in the way of exploits of the vulnerability. However, CISA has added to its known exploited vulnerabilities catalogue due to what it says was evidence of active exploitation. While Checkpoint also reported that it saw 37,000 attempts to exploit Spring 4 shell in the 4 days after the vulnerability was discovered, saying that 16% of organisations were impacted by attempts to exploit the bug. Now, it's not really clear what attempts means in that sense, if it was just kind of a scanning type situation. But Microsoft did also say that it was tracking a low volume of exploit attempts targeting the bug as well. However, I do think we can say that the bug, it hasn't been as impactful as, you know, perhaps some of the initial reports about the vulnerability indicated that it might be. Not yet, anyway.
Okay, well, that's a little bit of good news anyway, because usually attackers, anytime you hear about a bug like this, attackers are always jumping onto it. And it tends to crop up in various attacks for months afterwards. So long may it last. Let's wrap it up there, because that's about all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. And if you'd like to read our latest research, including those blogs about Cicada and VerbalCon, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.